May I give you the final reminder of the May 5th Conor Cruise O'Brien lecture, an extra lecture this year. This is the final night of our regular program, and I would like to express on your behalf and on my own thanks to all the people who have produced this program for us this winter, particularly the members of the Executive Committee, who are a remarkable group. I've not heard one yet say I'm too busy, though I know they're all very busy people. Dr. Kennedy, Dr. Chitty, and Mrs. Argue have borne particular loads. I think I've probably imposed on them more than I should have. Mr. George Morfitt is our honorary treasurer. I think honorary means only treasurer without pay. He does all the work of a treasurer and has done for a number of years. We're grateful to him. Dr. Vogt is called honorary secretary. He's without pay too. He's the honor arranger of things. Whatever needs to be done, Dr. Vogt does it. Last week I noticed afterwards he was carrying away the chairs. So that was without pay too. He's honorary chair remover on occasion. I think if you were to properly describe him, he's the general manager. Mrs. Bell Nemetz is called program chairman. She's not honorary. I'm not sure why that is, but it's fitting because there's not much honor and there's a lot of work to it. It's acceptable as a title because the program is what is Vancouver Institute. And of course, the person who's program chairman does a vast amount of the work. She's chairman of the board. Each year, she produces a better program than the year before. I think she'll have trouble next year because I think this year has just been an excellent series of programs. To complete this season, she has arranged a very special program. And I'll propose to deal with it in a special way. Though it is a concert, and I tell you that there will be a question period afterwards, as we've grown accustomed to at Vancouver Institute, and I've imposed on Professor Silverman, and he has agreed to that. I'm going to ask Dr. Vogt to introduce Professor Silverman.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been a banner year, the year of Peter Seaton, and I think we'll remember it for a long time. And we're all grateful to Peter Seaton for what he's done. And we're closing this year, a remarkable year, with a stellar performance. Let me first of all introduce the first star in the stellar performance, and that first star is the Boesendorfer piano that we have in front of you. It's I think, the best piano in Vancouver. It's made available by the T.K. Lee Music Company to Robert Silverman whenever he performs, and they made it available to us tonight. They're the people who are the agents in Vancouver for the Boesendorfer pianos. It's a beautiful instrument, and we're very pleased to have it tonight. The real star, of course, tonight is Robert Silverman, and he doesn't need much of an introduction to Vancouver audiences. He's going to be telling you a little bit about himself as a musician tonight. Let me simply recount one or two things about him. He was a Montrealer. He's had a varied career, but he's one of these people who's not only an outstanding performer, but also an outstanding teacher and lecturer about music. That combination is very rare indeed. I particularly enjoy his CBC broadcasts about musicians, and I also enjoy his performances. Today you're going to have a treat that very few audiences have had. They're going to hear Silverman both as a speaker and as a performer. And he really does both extremely well. There are many of us who believe that when he came to Vancouver to teach at the University of British Columbia 5 or 6 years ago, that the music world in Vancouver took a quantum jump forward. The Robert Silverman had won many prizes before then. He had come here as a dual graduate of the prestigious Eastman School of Music, where he got his doctorate in music, but he also simultaneously won his performer's degree. He has since that time performed in tours around the world. Last year, he had his debut at Lincoln Center, where he played two concerts in New York, and that was termed by the critics in New York as one of the most notable events, concert events of the year. There are many of us who think that Robert Silverman could easily, or might easily, be regarded as one of the very best pianists Canada has produced, or perhaps of our generation. Maybe we should provide him an even better PR press agency than he has and cultivate some eccentricities. But he performs in an outstanding way. He's very much in demand with symphony orchestras and on tours. He is just about to embark on a major tour of Australia and of Russia. And amidst all of these things, he continues to teach here superbly and to speak on radio broadcasts and combine all of these activities. We're really very grateful that he makes his base at UBC and in Vancouver, and we're really looking forward very much, all of us, to tonight's joint lecture and recital. Ladies and gentlemen, Robert Silverman.
Does Dr. Vogt exaggerate like that all the time, or? Well, it's true that I have lectured in the past, not so much this year. And it's also true that I do play quite a number of concerts, but I haven't really done both of them at once to any great extent. And it was a bit of an experiment for me. I hope it works. In any case, I'm sure that many of you recall the opening of Woody Allen's movie, Annie Hall, where he just is on screen by himself and talking to the audience and telling him that he just turned 40. And then he immediately goes on to assure them that, don't worry, it's not a big thing for me. I mean, I'm not worried by this balding spot here or anything like that. Well, last May, I turned 40, and my bald spot is no bother either, particularly now that I've learned how to comb my hair to disguise the fact. But as Eric mentioned, a couple of other things happened around last May also, professionally and artistically, so that the momentous occasion of turning 40 passed, if not unnoticed, then at least without too much trauma. It was when I made my first appearances in New York. And I really hesitate to use the word debut because, as far as I'm concerned, no one has made a debut in New York since Horowitz 50 years ago. That's a debut. And it's true, I think that although some people know that I play the piano moderately well, I haven't become a world-famous star overnight as a result of these concerts. Probably I won't either. But At the same time, the reaction of the press and the informed public seemed to indicate that I was someone whose playing should be reckoned with. But it was really in the preparing for these two recitals that the most important event took place. I think I became a much finer pianist than I had ever been before. And maybe this, then, is a good time and perhaps an appropriate occasion to take stock of where I am artistically, where I've come from, and where I'm heading. Because I played with the Montreal Symphony Orchestra for the first time at the age of 14. Now I'm just about 41. So in another 27 years, it'll be at least time, if not to quit, then at least to wonder about how much longer I want the glamorous life of hustling up concerts and living out of suitcases in Sandman Inns. In other words, I am approaching midstream in my career, and at the same time, rather belatedly, I've arrived at some kind of artistic maturity. And 40 is rather late. In New York, I was constantly asked, in interviews, by friends, people, why I waited so long before playing there. And I always managed to resist the temptation to say, one of two things, what's so special about New York? Or, what I really should have said was perhaps you should have heard me at 30 and 35, then you'd know why I waited till I was 40. But in a sense, this was true, because at a time when most serious pianists are practicing like mad as teenagers, even before university or before conservatory, I was practicing too, about half an hour a week. And I was interested in a lot of other things, like hockey. I actually played a little bit of organized hockey when I was about 16. And everybody who did this, who signed up with this team, had to sign another piece of paper that was probably totally illegal, but nonetheless, we had to sign it saying that if we turned into half-decent hockey players, we would have to play for the sponsoring organization. And so to date, I think I'm still the only Canadian concert pianist who's the property of the Montreal Canadiens. Not that I was any good. I got two assists the whole season, and they were both against my own team. I really was not at that point, and I have the tapes to prove it, I was not a child prodigy at the piano. Then when I finished high school, I went into engineering for 3 years, and the less said about that, the better. I ended up with a BA in humanities, and then for lack of anything else to do, I started studying practicing the piano a little more than half an hour a week. And really, my serious study began at the age of 23. I went away, I got a Canada Council grant, I studied for 2 years in Vienna, I returned. I didn't have a Bachelor of Music degree, I got that at McGill at the age of 26, then went to the Eastman School of Music. And I still remember, at the age of 28, for the very first time in my life, playing a piece of music with the sudden awareness that my fingers could and would obey some of my artistic demands. Still, I think now that I look back upon this time, I took music seriously, but not all that seriously. I always had a lot of other interests. And it was really only around the age of about 33 or so, 34, that I made my major commitment to the piano and gave up a lot of other silly hobbies that weren't getting me anywhere. And I really doubled the time and the intensity of my practice. And although it's true that I suppose any artist likes to discount his or her early work. I really feel I'm right in saying that I've made a lot of progress in my playing since my arrival here in 1973, at about the age of 35 or so. And it's apparent to me, particularly when I compare, let's say, my current performance of the very first piece I played when I arrived at UBC, my first recital here in October of 73, where I started with a sonata of Joseph Haydn. And I put it away shortly after playing it then, but recently resuscitated it. And of course, every time I study a new piece, particularly if it hasn't been, or an older piece, particularly if it hasn't been in a number of years, I don't just take it off the shelf, as it were, but restudy it as though it's a new work. And it's amazing how different it really is. I don't play it as fast, to begin with, although that quickness at which I played that performance, I'm not sure was totally voluntary. And for all I know, I might play it twice as fast in a couple of minutes right now, as I intend to. But I think I've been paying much more attention to sound, to delicacy, to rhythmic stability. Incidentally, Haydn as a composer fascinates me. He was an extremely prolific man. I'm sure many of you know he wrote 104 symphonies, about 84 string quartets, 62 piano sonatas, and then there's a lot of other stuff that we never even hear, operas, church music, a lot of piano trios, and a lot of other assorted chamber music and various other pieces. And when you think of it, though, his life spanned, he lived for quite a long time, about 77 years. He was born in 1732, died 1809. In other words, when he was born, Bach had 18 years left to live. He was at the height of his career. And when Haydn died, the Eroica had already been composed. And this transition, this major transition from the Baroque style to the classical and post-classical, almost into the Romantic, could not have come about in any way resembling the way it happened if it hadn't been for Haydn. Because when Haydn began his serious career, really the great classical forms, the symphony, concerto, sonata, were really in their infancy and were really more of a diversionary kind of pieces rather than serious works of art. But by the time Haydn was through writing vast numbers of each of these forms, the works had reached their maturity, and they weren't going to get any better. They were going to get different, but they weren't going to get better. Haydn was responsible for much of this, and I think it really hardly likely that music would have been the same without him. I think I will take a drink of water and then play a Haydn sonata.
Thank you.
When I was first asked by Mrs. Nemetz to come here and address you, my first reaction was a little like that which Arthur Schnabel had when he was asked to give a whole series of lectures at the University of Chicago. He said, I'm really a gardener, not a botanist. But it was made clear that really what was wanted was really primarily for me to play and not to talk all that much. I mean, you had a lot of smart people with intelligent and very famous parents to do all that. But that perhaps I could say a few words too. And I agree to it. In fact, in a way, it is a challenge to talk about one's art, particularly performing, because it's such an abstract thing. And a performance really exists only for the few minutes in which it's going on. Then it's lost forever, unless it's preserved on record. And probably because of this, many popular misconceptions arise. For instance, I have some good friends on this faculty, not the Department of Music, but in general, who, when I just happened to mention, I said, you know, I feel my playing is sort of taking a bit of an intellectual bent lately. They said, intellectual? What are you talking about? And probably they were under the impression, as perhaps many people are, that all a performer does is practice, and then at the concert, he puts his hands on the keyboard, and whatever comes out is an unconscious expression of his artistry. And if pianist A is better than pianist B, it's because A is more talented or he practiced harder. And in a sense, I don't think anyone can really be blamed for having this misconception, because I've had quite a few students who, when they first started studying with me, their thinking was not any more sophisticated than that. The fact is, before a decent performer begins to lay his hands on the piano, some important decisions have to be made regarding the conceptualizing of the piece he's about to study or perform. Questions regarding style, tempo, the range of dynamics to be used. This piano, for instance, can make a lot more noise than it did, but this is Haydn, not Prokofiev. Phrasing, how to phrase, where to phrase, sound quality, pedaling, rhythmic flexibility. These are just a few of things that just crossed my mind. And also one very important one for me, how to imbue the performance with a sense of unity, if the piece has a sense of unity. Actually, I was thinking about it, and perhaps an analogy with acting might be helpful, if a little simplistic. For an actor must be able to determine through careful study of the play how complex his character should be, how that character should react to various events that transpire in the drama, and how he should interact with all the other characters. And I would imagine that his solutions to these questions govern just about everything, all the facets of the portrayal of his role, vocalization, inflections, body language. And of course, there is another simpler task which confronts the actor, and that is, I think it's simpler, to make the lines intelligible through phrasing and punctuation of the sentences so that the audience can understand what he's saying. Now, musical performers, too, face both of these problems. But the second of these is proportionately much greater, because although music is a language with its own grammar and its syntax, even though it's nonverbal, it is a language or a group of languages, The coherent rendering of the music structure is much more difficult because of its abstract quality. And because also the performer cannot rely, as an actor can, on an audience's familiarity with the language he is using. And actually, I spend quite a bit of effort and time analyzing a composition to ensure that each phrase is not only well delineated, but also that it fits in with everything surrounding it. This really wasn't always the case. My early training was with a very fine musician, but frankly, at that point, her teaching was more of the copycat kind of variety. Do this here, do that there. She had good instincts, and she probably knew why she wanted things done like that, but nonetheless, I never got any reasons why. And so consequently, whenever I played, I either relied on her very good taste, or else my hands did most of the thinking. Never occurred to me to think about a piece away from the piano, for instance. But then, when I arrived at Eastman, I came into contact, rather through a roundabout manner which I won't bother going into, with a very interesting man. In fact, if Reader's Digest ever asks me to do the most unforgettable character routine I ever met, it will be this man. His name is Leonard Shure, and he was an assistant at a very young age to Arthur Schnabel. I have about 3 hours of Leonard Shure's stories, which I really won't tell. I wonder if any of you ever knew him as a pianist. He, at some point or other, he still teaches, and at some point or other, he was really a very fine pianist. But what I really remember most of all, and what was most valuable, was not even a lesson, but a lecture he gave on Beethoven's Opus 110, where literally he showed how every single note had a reason for being the note it was and where it was. And in the first lesson that I took, I just played something, and he just stopped me. He says, "Why did you do that?" And for the life of me, I had absolutely no answer and felt like an utter fool. Since then, and particularly, though, in the last 6 years, I've really tried very hard to bring more and more into consciousness, to rely less and less on my instincts, not to deny whatever innate musicality I may have, but rather to direct it towards a more conscious mode of expression. I've done things like eliminate a lot of obvious gestures in my playing, like swooping up to the high note of a phrase every time there's a high note of a phrase, or bringing out an inner voice as though it were the most important thing ever written. I've tried to work for more transparency than I ever had, to try to let every note on a page be heard, if at all possible, since the composer wrote every note on the page. I've tried to work towards some sort of rhythmic consistency. I don't mean mechanical keeping to the beat, but rather to let, if I'm going to fluctuate my tempos, to do so gradually, unless the composer specifically asks for something to be done more suddenly, to avoid hairpin turns in tempo, or to avoid, I guess, what would be the driving equivalent of putting the gas pedal on when you see a stop sign ahead of you. And while doing this, to try to impart a sense of warmth, a nice tone, as nice as I'm capable of, beauty of phrasing, or even a big sound and rhythmic drive where that's called for, but never losing control, never letting the piece get away from me. I'm not saying I achieve that at all times. In fact, I don't, but that's, I feel, a goal worth striving for. And also, in the last 6 years, I have really made an effort to improve my technique, which was, at some point in my life, very unreliable. And by this, I don't mean pyrotechnics, brilliance for its own sake, but rather just so that my fingers can be reliable and accurate, I can feel moderately comfortable with them, and that they can serve whatever musical ends I feel they should be serving at any given time. I mentioned Beethoven's Opus 110, and I've played that quite a bit in town, but that's what I brought with me, nonetheless. So I think I will play it now. This is late Beethoven. It's a magnificent work, as one of many pieces that by Beethoven, Brahms, the greatest composer, as music which is greater than it can possibly be played. And certainly this is true. Every time I study it, I discover things that I hadn't known existed in it before, and I'm sure this will go on through the rest of my life. The one thing that does interest me very much is this last movement, which is the by far the weightiest and longest. It starts off with a very eerie introduction with some crazy sound effects that Beethoven had at that point only in his mind, or nothing that no one has ever been able to figure out exactly what he meant. He has notes that are repeated, the second one, or they seem to be tied, and yet he wants a different finger played on the second note than the first, even though they are tied. And there's probably no one has the definite answer about what, I mean, you can't go and ask him. So we all try to just work that out as best we can. Anyway, that's the introduction. And then there are then four sections to this final movement. There's a section which in German he calls Klagender Gesang, which really means sad song. Thank goodness he didn't speak English. And this is just what it says. It's a sad song. There's chords accompanying a very beautiful melody in the right hand. This leads to a fugue that seems, anyway, to me, to be rather consoling in its gestures and in its character. And it builds up and becomes a little more triumphant towards the end. And just about when you think, well, thank you, Beethoven, it's really been a great sonata, all of a sudden, bang, with one note, he does an about-face and brings us again into a minor key. And this time, though, he presents a variation of that Klagender Gesang, sad song, but this time it's much more grief-ridden. It's as though the singer was so choked by the tragedy that he or she could never get out any more than one or two notes, couldn't catch his or her breath to sing a long line, so the line gets chopped up into little fragments. And then the song, that's the song, he goes through it again. It's just exactly as we heard it the first time, except in this fragmented fashion. And then come one of the most amazing moments in all of Beethoven. Nine chords, exactly the same one, but getting fuller, as going from pianissimo to, he doesn't say exactly how loud to get, he just says crescendo. And again, how to interpret these signs. He does other things, like he wants you to put the pedal on and yet play staccato. And with the soft pedal on, too. It's very enigmatic section and takes much less time to play than I have talking about it. But what seems to me anyway, it speaks to me as some sort of cleansing after the grief. And then he begins the fugue again, this time an inversion of the melody we heard before. Don't worry if you don't know what that means. It's not that important. But just as the first fugue really consoled, this one starts off very tentatively, but builds up to much greater proportions than anything else actually in the whole piece, and ends in a glorious triumph. So, Beethoven, Opus 110. approve, but I've begun to give some thought to whether I should really spend the remainder of my career working for more of the same, or whether I should be heading out in different directions. Because there's no question in my mind, and also probably in those who have heard me over many years, that in my efforts to gain better control of the instrument, and better musical control too, there's no question that I gave up a degree of immediacy that used to be present in my playing to a much greater degree than it is now. This is a trade-off that I've been very happy to make. I think I've benefited from it. And furthermore, I don't think that really too many things I do sound contrived, at least to me, but they do sound planned to everybody who listens seriously. And furthermore, my method of analyzing music is relatively consistent and quite obvious, too. So that after a while, I think the intelligent listener can forecast how I'm going to play a piece before I sit down and play it. And I've really begun to ask whether this is a good thing or not, or whether I should always try to work for having a few more surprises, the unexpected, at my disposal. I can't see there really being any total about faces in the near future in my basic performing style, but I have been trying to expand the directions from which I approach music. And to help me do this, I've begun exploring music that I'd never played really anything of to speak beforehand. Turn-of-the-century Russian music, Rachmaninoff, Scriabin, because this is as obviously emotional as great music gets, and it lends itself also to a wide variety of interpretive standpoints. So I think what I will do is to finish with two works by Rachmaninoff, two etudes tableaux, one in C major, and one in E flat minor.
Thank you.
has agreed to accept questions. Two or three. And we'll impose that much longer on him. Does anybody wish to ask, to raise a subject or ask a question? Eric?
We should probably ask you to play another piece.
No. You mustn't.
I wonder. You speak a lot about other musicians. I wonder how important it is in your present development as a musician to listen to other pianists, such as Morowitz and Solomon's Records and other pianists.
Of the utmost importance. There are some musicians who disagree with me and who feel they have to just retreat into their own world and not be exposed to outside influences. But that's not my way. I learn a great deal whenever I'm preparing a new work. I invariably pick up as many recordings as I can get from as many pianists whom I respect and listen to them and try to steal as many ideas as I've... No, actually, I'm not above that. I mean, if you hear someone do something beautiful, why not? But essentially, just to get different ideas, different approaches, I feel it's necessary. One of the, shall I say, drawbacks to living in this very beautiful place is that we have a lot of music in Vancouver, but there aren't that many world-famous pianists, great pianists, who come here. Just a handful of recitals a year, if that many. And Ashkenazi came this year, so naturally it was my luck to be out of town when he was here. But people who live in New York don't have that problem. They can hear whoever they want, whenever they want, just about. But here, that's difficult. So I find it very necessary to do the next best thing and get hold of recordings and do a lot of listening so as to keep world-class playing in my head as an ideal to live up to. Yes?
When you're playing a piece of music, do you think exclusively about that piece? Are you critical in any way about it, or are there other thoughts that intervene?
I try to did you all hear the question? Do I think when I'm playing a piece of music, do I think only about that piece? I like to, most of the time. Of course, everybody's mind wanders every now and then, both in performance and certainly in practicing. But I do try to focus in on the piece of music, and this sort of program that I gave you for the Beethoven aside, once I image that in my mind, then I think just about the musical means for achieving that image. And another thing is that when, no matter what piece of music I'm playing, I always want to somehow or other be able to convince myself that it's the greatest piece of music ever written, so that I can be convinced by it and therefore be as convincing as I can be.
There's a fellow there that's anxious right here.
I'm afraid it's a late work, but I'm sure it was. I mean, the larger keyboard really only came into being after that, really throughout during Beethoven's career. And this was written, I think the date used to be given as 1791, but I think it's been revised now. It is very modern for its time. Haydn was always very modern for his time. Particularly, you're probably thinking about some of those wrong turns in the last movement where he seemed to go off into all sorts of keys. And I really think that's what he was experimenting with, almost as a sort of a comedy routine where the pianist is rushing helter-skelter, getting lost, backtracking, going ahead, stopping, starting, stopping, getting lost again. I thought that was, I sort of had that idea that that's what he had in mind. But it is a incredibly modern piece for its time. Haydn was always an experimenter. And throughout his career, if you look at things that he's always, in every piece, he's trying something new, a new idea. Some of them didn't work, they're mistakes, and he never makes the same mistake twice. He realizes a mistake and goes on to something else. But he never